Hello, I'm Matthew Bradbury, and welcome to The Beverage Report, a student-led podcast ran out of the London School of Economics, Department of Economics. Welcome to Series 2 of the Economics Department's podcast. To recap Season 1, we discussed the financial crisis, and we hosted expertise from all around. Lord Alistair Darling, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sir Charlie Bean, Chief Economist of the Bank of England, and Deputy Governor there as well as prestigious economists from the LSE itself, including Professor Silvana Torreno, Ricardo Ruiz, and Vata Denhan. Now, coming into Season 2, we'll be discussing the policy response to COVID-19 as it develops. We hope to host a similar level of expertise again, drawing from the Treasury, the Bank of England, and, of course, the LSE itself. Kicking things off today, we'll be hosting Professor the Lord Mervyn King, who was Governor of the Bank of England from 2003 to 2013. In that time, he oversaw two very distinct periods, the calm of the Great Moderation, which was the years leading up to the financial crisis, where Gordon Brown had dubbed we'd ended the boom and bust cycle. Then, of course, there was 2007 onwards, where we were all blissfully reminded that the boom and bust cycle was still alive and kicking. With Lord King today, we discuss the financial crisis, the role that economists play in policy decisions, and then looking back at this time, his being at the helm of the Bank of England, discussing what challenges the bank faces now, what challenges economists, modellers face now, face of COVID-19. So without further ado, thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Lord Mervyn King, thank you for taking the time out to join us today. I suppose, first off, how have you been adjusting to life under lockdown?
Rather straightforwardly, I confess that the fact that I have to work at home has freed me up to finish a lot of work that I had in train, to catch up with things I put to one side, not to waste time traveling to and from meetings or other events. So I've been one of the fortunate people that have been able to adjust relatively easily.
I'm glad to hear. So there was an announcement on the BBC this morning that the economy grew at negative 2% the first 3 months of this year, including a negative 6% while under lockdown. Could you please put the threat faced by COVID-19 into context? Like, how do you think this compares to the financial crisis, the Great Depression?
Well, in one respect, it's very different. In another respect, there are some similarities. The difference is that I think words like recession and downturn don't really have much relevance to the current situation. This is not a recession generated by the unwillingness of the private sector to produce or spend. This is the result of a mandated shutdown of the economy by the government. And I think it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for the statisticians to measure the precise fall in output or indeed the subsequent rise. So I don't think we should pay much attention to the precise numbers that are coming out, either of official data or indeed of people's forecasts. And it will be much more dramatic than was the financial crisis for that reason. But there are some similarities between the two, the most important one of which is that they are both examples of what John Kay and I call in our new book, radical uncertainty. That is, we knew something, but nowhere near enough. We knew that there were things called banking crises, and we knew there were things called pandemics. But that did not enable us to predict either when or where or of what kind of financial crisis we would experience, or what kind of epidemic resulting from an unknown virus we would experience. And we had to confront this without the ability to be able to forecast accurately, certainly not to attach probabilities to various events. We had to think our way through it. That's the similarity in both cases. And I think that one of the things that's worth remembering is that the attempt to argue that the science tells us today what we should do in response to the epidemic of COVID-19 is highly misleading. The models used by the epidemiologists are just as uncertain as the models used by economists to forecast the economy. And in both cases, for the same reason. These are unique events. They're one-offs. They are similarities with events in the past. But the parameters driving the behavior of the economy on the one hand or the epidemic on the other are highly uncertain, and we don't know what they are. and we may learn over time, but we certainly don't know now. And so I think that it's a mistake of governments today, as it was in the financial crisis, to rely on published forecasts by so-called experts, whether economists or epidemiologists, because human behavior is of the essence unpredictable. And we found it very difficult to know how people would respond to the financial crisis right through 2008. It was 1 month, it seemed as if people were regaining confidence into the banking system. The next month, they'd lost it again. And with the epidemic, we really cannot forecast the precise number of infections or deaths because we cannot easily predict how individuals will respond to the measures that are imposed on them, or indeed, which is relevant now, how they will respond to the relaxation of the restrictions as we go forward. So a much more humility about our forecasting ability is required.
So if we always knew that financial crises could happen, and we always knew that pandemics could happen, but as you say, we never would have guessed it would have came in from Wuhan in 2019. How can you try and build resilience against this type of radical uncertainty? Especially when, by its very nature, it's uncertain. So attempts to try and measure bank stability just before 2008, and the Basel system measured Northern Rock being one of the most stable. How can policymakers respond to these events we know can happen, but can never quite predict the details of?
Well, I think the crucial thing is the word you used there, which is resilience. The big lesson from the possibility of radically uncertain events occurring is not to pretend we can forecast when they will happen, but to build resilience and robustness into all the critical systems in the economy, and certainly banking and the health system count as critical. The big mistake, I think, in 2008, 2007, the build-up to it, was to pretend that the very precise quantitative models used to calculate the regulations to apply to banks turned out to be wholly misleading. They were totally unhelpful. And you need a much simpler approach. Robustness, after all, is all about dealing with a situation where you can't really know what kind of things will happen. There are two things you know about a banking crisis. One is that the symptom of it will be that banks run out of cash. That is, that people that lend to banks, whether it be depositors or whether it be large wholesale institutions, many of these people lend to banks for very short horizons, overnight or a week or even up to 3 months. If these people decide that they don't want to carry on lending to banks, banks run out of cash. So they need access to it. So either you have to ensure that banks themselves have large cash reserves, which is what we did until about 40 or 50 years ago, or you need a mechanism by which banks have to pay an insurance premium of kinds to the central bank in order to have access to unlimited cash borrowing from the central bank. And in my previous book, The End of Alchemy, I put forward some proposals for how that could be carried out. I'm sure there are other ways of doing it, but ensuring that banks have access to liquidity is crucial, whatever the cause of the crisis. That's the symptom. The underlying problem is always going to be people's concerns about the solvency of banks. And from that point of view, I think it doesn't make sense to try to be too clever and calculate sophisticated, risk-weighted capital requirements. It is much more sensible to say, how much equity have banks issued so that we know that there are enough equity shareholders around to absorb losses before they start to worry about defaulting to their creditors. And there's no scientific way in which you can calculate the optimal capital requirement, but you have to make a common sense judgment and ensure that banks do issue enough equity. What was absolutely clear in 2008 was that we had failed to ensure that banks either had sufficient cash reserves or had issued enough equity. The regulators had, in common with all international regulation, been pressured by the financial system to allow them to run down their margin for error in order to become more efficient and more profitable. And I think the same lesson is going to be learnt now after the epidemic. Our health system needs to be much more resilient and robust. I think it's fair to say that people have shown extraordinary ingenuity in providing additional intensive care beds, the Nightingale hospitals in Britain have been put up, haven't really needed to use them, but we did put them up very quickly, and we have been able to cope. But I don't think we should rely on leaving it to the last minute. I'm sure that what will come out of this is a much greater appreciation of the need to hold proper and updated stocks of protective equipment, of swabs to enable tests to be carried out once we know what we're looking for, and the ability to create almost a reserve army of people who can be called back into work in the health service should there be a peak in demand for requirements to have staff to operate the extra beds and equipment that we have on hand. The ability to make the health system more resilient in the face of some unknowable, unpredictable potential demand on healthcare services. That, I think, is bound to be something that we will want to do. And I think this may spread over more generally to business, in which people will say, you know, making our business just that bit more efficient, a bit more profitable, leaner in normal times makes us attractive because we're more profitable. But if people worry about our survival in the event of a big shock, we should rely less on the cheapest just-in-time supply chains and instead try to move more to have backup chains of supply, make our entire operations more resilient. So there are things you can do, but the important thing is to stop trying to be too clever and pretend that we can quantify the responses that we will need when we can't predict the timing or the nature or the magnitude of some development in the future.
So Ben Bernanke, your American counterpart during the financial crisis, was a learned scholar of the Great Depression. So he often talks about very actively considering the lessons of history while working in 2008, trying very actively not to make the same mistakes that the Fed had during the Great Depression. So when you were working in the Bank of England, did you have such historical parallels in mind? And in that you're quite cynical about the usefulness of models, do you think that a knowledge of history is essential for economists or policymakers in lieu of those models?
I do. And I had, for the previous 5 or 6 years, as soon as I became governor, I set up a dining club where, together with people from outside the Bank of England, one or two journalists, academics, people in the city, we used to meet twice a year and studied a particular financial episode of the past to learn general lessons. And I don't think one can approach this by saying we must try to avoid the mistakes made in the past, because no two crises are the same. But there are general lessons. And I drew on that heavily in our tackling the financial crisis from 2007 through 2009 and 10 and so on. And that was very important to me. Whereas I think the difficulty with the models that are used is that people, I think, misuse models. It's not that models are wrong in themselves, but models in economics are not literal descriptions of the world. In our book, John Kay and I describe the experience of the American space agency NASA when it sent a rocket to Mercury. And it took 7 years to get there. And when it arrived exactly at the place and time that it had been predicted, 7 years earlier. And the reason for that was threefold. First, that the laws governing the movement of rockets and the planets have been known for centuries, and we've been able to study them, and we are confident we know what they are. Secondly, that those laws don't change over time. The system is stationary in the technical sense. And thirdly, that the movements of planets do not depend on what we believe about them. None of these assumptions hold true of the economy. We don't fully understand the behavior of the economy. The laws governing the movement of the economy do change over time, and they certainly depend on what we believe about it, because our expectations are one of the important driving forces of the economy. So models cannot be used as a literal description of the world. What they are useful for is parables. They provide insights into how we think about the world. And they're very important insights. Some of those models may be highly mathematical. Some of them may be simply verbal. It doesn't matter. What matters is the quality of the insight we get from the model. And we should never confuse the model with the world. That, I think, is one of the great dangers of using models in macroeconomic forecasting, that people end up confusing the model with the world. and believing that their model surely must be right, given how much time they spent on it, there's something wrong with the world instead. And that, in fact, is not the case usually. We need to use many different models to obtain relevant insights. And sometimes we need to recognize that the model that had been providing useful insights is no longer doing so, and we need to think in a quite different way.
In response to 2008, the Bank of England began using what's been dubbed unconventional monetary policy, things like quantitative easing. So you talk there about the value of models to provide insights, but sometimes you need to break new ground and do things for which there isn't a precedent. Or not much of a precedent, like quantitative easing. So what were the conversations like when you decided to adopt that? And what else was on the table, but at the end you decided not to run with?
Well, this was an interesting experience, and it does relate to the issue about models, as you suggest. The use of quantitative easing to expand the money supply is actually a rather traditional form of monetary policy. It's open market operations. People had got used in the 20 years before the financial crisis to the idea that the way central banks influenced the economy was by changing interest rates. Now, of course, changing interest rates also was a mechanism for influencing the growth of the broad money supply. You didn't have to believe in some precise or mechanical link between broad money supply and the movement of the economy to believe that the amount of money in the economy was an important influence on it. Indeed, anyone who's read Keynes would be hard put to imagine that money was irrelevant to the behavior of the economy. So when we came to do quantitative easing, it really wasn't that unconventional. The scale of it was, but not the mechanism. Open market operations were fairly traditional. And in the 1980s, the UK had the experience of occasional periods of overfunding and underfunding, which corresponded to trying to increase the broad money supply or reduce it by the central bank getting involved in debt management. I personally didn't think it was that unconventional. But many people did, and the reason they did, because it didn't feature in their latest new Keynesian models. And they were also very reluctant, including the Federal Reserve, to describe quantitative easing as a policy to boost the money supply. They talked about it as credit easing. Now, this is slightly odd because the direct impact of quantitative easing is that the central bank buys financial assets, usually government bonds, from the private sector. The private sector in return gets a check drawn on the central bank. They take that check to their own commercial bank and deposit it, and their bank account deposits are credited with that full amount. That increases the broad money supply. So the immediate consequence of QE is to boost the broad money supply one for one with the amount of QE. The interesting questions, of course, about how does that impact on people's behavior and affect the rest of the economy? And it can happen through a wide variety of channels. People can use them extra money in their bank accounts to rebalance their portfolios, either buying longer-term government bonds or foreign currency bonds, thereby affecting the exchange rate, or equities or corporate bonds, or indeed even spending more. So there are many ways in which, many channels through which this increase in the money supply can work through. Most of the models that we were using and that people wanted to present of a new Keynesian kind had no financial sector to speak of and therefore could not capture any of these effects. So here was a situation where the models, which had been quite useful in helping us to think about the ability of monetary policy to smooth the economy in response to various shocks to the economy, once we knew what the shock was here, this was not a exogenous shock. This was a collapse of confidence in the banking system and the resulting collapse in demand around the world. We had to think about what measures we had to take. And the insights from earlier models and earlier monetary theory was actually more helpful and relevant than some of the latest modern fashionable models. So there were conversations around it. And I found it much easier to explain QE in terms of trying to boost the money supply, given that the banking system was contracting its lending. And because the one iron law of economics is double entry bookkeeping, if the asset side of the bank system is contracting, then so must the liability side. And so bank deposits were also falling. And bank deposits account for 95% of broad money supply. So the private sector through the banking system was contracting the money supply, and which was actually falling, which could have led to a very serious depression. Our job was to offset that to some extent, and the size of our money supply being created through electronic money printing was small relative to the total. So basically, we had to double or treble or go much further in expanding our contribution to the money supply in order to stop the overall total from actually contracting. And we were successful in doing it. But I think I didn't find it helpful to pretend that some very precise model could tell us what would happen. The basic insight was that we were trying to offset a decline in money supply generated by a loss of confidence in the banking system, and QE was the best way of doing that. And so that's what we did.
So in 2006, Greg Mankiw said that, quote, "The sad truth of macroeconomic research of the past three decades is that it has had only a minor impact on the practical analysis of monetary or fiscal policy." I mean, he says this talking about America, but do you think that this is also representative of the UK? And then if so, why do you think it is? Do you not think it's weird that there's such a large disconnect between academia ostensibly studying the economy and, you know, the policymakers ostensibly keeping the economy running?
Well, I have some sympathy with Greg Mankiw's comment, but not entirely so. I said earlier that the models we should use are useful in terms of providing insights, not forecasts. And I think we have had some very helpful insights from the research of the past three or four decades. So I think the rational expectations revolution was helpful in making it absolutely clear that if you want to introduce a public policy, you need to take into account the response of the private sector to it. And the private sector may offset some of the impact of the measures that you take. So you can't just change government spending or taxes and assume that the private sector will go on behaving in the same way as it did before. That's an important insight. And I think that was taken on board, and it led to the realization that if a government would try to boost the economy in the short term, that might lead to somewhat higher inflation that would generate greater activity and employment just prior to an election. That if the private sector worked out that that's what the government was likely to do, then its inflation expectations would go up, and you might not get the impact on the employment and output that you would like to see. In the long run, central banks can control only inflation, not the long run level of activity. These were important insights. I think also the whole rationale for inflation targeting, which was to create an environment in which people anchored their expectations to the target, didn't worry about inflation. That gave them a sense of confidence that made it more likely that they would invest at a lower interest rate. They would, for a given interest rate, they'd be prepared to invest more than they did before. All of these things were very helpful and useful insights. What's clear, however, is that there was a degree of hubris. I mean, Bob Lucas is a very great economist, but he did say at one stage that we solved the problem of macroeconomics. We know how to prevent recessions and control booms. And that turned out obviously to be false, because we had the biggest downturn since the Great Depression in 2008-09. And there was far too much confidence, I think, in pretending that the insights we'd gained from the models led us to assume that the models described the world and therefore we could control it. We couldn't. My interpretation of all this is that where Greg is right is relative to the inflated expectations that people had of the economic analysis. If we simply regard these models as exercises that give us insights, parables about the world, then we won't go wrong, but it leaves a whole field of endeavor for practical policy making, which has to operate in a sphere of radical uncertainty, in which thinking through the problem, taking into account the insights from economics, but without the pretense that we can forecast the future, makes policy making both an art and a science, and why it's so fascinating. But the theory doesn't tell you what to do.
And then now, as we move into the COVID crisis, as I'm sure it'll be dubbed something in years to come, the Bank of England's been relying a lot less on interest rates just simply because it's so close to the lower bounds. So the bank's been doing more quantitative easing, more things like supporting small businesses and taking on a lot more risk. Do you think that the recent actions could be characterized as outside of the bank's remit? And if so, do you think that all of this could one day threaten the bank's independence?
I don't think what the Bank of England has done has gone outside its remit, is buying primarily government debt. I think what the Federal Reserve has done definitely has gone outside what I think is the safe remit of a central bank, in that it's been acquiring debt and other securities issued by the private sector and also by levels of government below the federal level. And the risk of that is that these are clearly fiscal decisions and they involve choosing which communities or regions and which sectors of the economy are going to get the support. And that is something which is the role of government to take, not central banks. And if central banks do take these decisions, it's also true of the great debate in the euro area now, where the European Central Bank wants to try to compress the interest rate differentials on sovereign debt between member countries. But that is outside the remit of the central bank as given by the European treaty with a no bailout clause. And it's something which government ought to be doing. Now, here I think that once we get past this episode, governments are going to say, well, you know, central banks have been taking these decisions to favor or not favor one part of the economy over another. That's not what they should be doing. That's our job. And therefore, we want to have more say over what central banks do. So I think that if central banks go outside their remit of deciding how much money should be created in good times and bad, and I think QE is a perfectly respectable and normal way of doing that, but once central banks go beyond that to involve decisions that favor one sector of the economy over another, then they are taking actions that will invite the government and politicians in general to come back and say, we need more control over you. And that will indeed threaten the independence of central banks and perhaps their ability to control monetary policy.
So there's a lot of students that listen to this podcast, and exams will soon be over and they'll have a lot of time on their hands. What are three books you think everyone should read? Or say five if the first two are The End of Alchemy and Radical Uncertainty.
Well, I think those certainly ought to be on the list. You could read them twice, of course. That would leave only one left. The First World War is well worth studying. The measures that were taken at the beginning of the First World War. If you read any history of the First World War, you may get three or four pages only on the story of the financial crisis. But there are one or two good books which study what happened to the city and to New York at the beginning of that financial crisis. I think it's also worth studying what happened in the Weimar Republic with the great inflation. The Economic Consequences of the Peace by Keynes is a good polemic to read about what happened at the end of the First World War. If you try to think of things which are particularly relevant, you know, to economists, obviously Lords of Finance is a very good book about the interwar period and the Great Depression. There's a very nice one-volume history of the Bank of England by David Kynaston, K-Y-N-A-S-T-O-N, called Till Time's Last Stand. That is also certainly worth looking at. I think those are the things that I would recommend in terms of history.
Perfect. And then finally, to wrap up, what gives you hope?
I think what gives me hope are a combination of two things. One is the observation that in the last 6 weeks, we have seen extraordinary ingenuity by people to cope with something that they couldn't really ever have imagined happening in terms of compressing the economy. The ability to build the Nightingale hospitals in just a couple of weeks or so. The way in which people have adapted to remote working and remote teaching even. That's one aspect. Human beings have enormous ingenuity. The second that gives me hope is the conclusion of our book on radical uncertainty points out that all the best things in life come out of radical uncertainty, uncertainty we can't imagine. The people that you will meet in the future, the jobs that you will have in the future, the places you'll visit, the books you'll read, the music you'll listen to. The excitement you'll get from the future will come because it was something you never imagined could happen, both on the downside with the COVID-19 epidemic, but in the future, There'll be so many things on the upside that will result from uncertainty. I would say to everyone taking exams and looking forward to the summer, don't worry about the future being uncertain. That's the opportunity. That's what makes life worth living. If I could tell you today what was going to happen to you, you'd be bored out of your mind. Embrace the uncertainty that you face. Relish the ingenuity that humans have that computers don't have, and look forward to that. The future is yours, if not my generation's.
Lord Mervyn King, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And to you, the listener, we thank you for listening, and we hope you tune in again next time.